This is Red at CKUT.
It's on? It's on?
Need dog. You know what I'm saying? CKUT
90.3 FM.
This is Kyle.
You're tuned into Radio Rénovation on CKUT 90.3 FM in Jaujage, Montreal. I'm Caroline Kunzle and I'll be hosting today, while our regular host Clara Swan enjoys some vacation time in Greece. Radio Rénovation aims to highlight the human stories behind the giant wave of gentrification, renovictions, and huge rent increases hitting Montreal. Today we're going to hear the story of someone whose young family is getting kicked out of their home, not via rent eviction, but because the new owner of their building wants to give the apartment to his family member. Legally, the landlord is entitled to do this, but it still doesn't make it right. It's another case of, as our anonymous interviewer puts it, the inherent power imbalance existing in the landlord-tenant relationship. Let's have a listen to his story.
Yeah, we live in Park X in a 5.5.
And there's yourself, your partner, and you have a little one, I think, right?
Yeah. We've been in our apartment for 7 years now. And for most of those 7 years, it's my partner and I. And, you know, my partner is a newcomer to Montreal. Like, she moved here from the States via Russia. And so Park X was the first neighborhood that she ever lived in Montreal, like it is for a lot of immigrants and new arrivals here. And she really grew to love it. And I've loved it over the years. I'm from Montreal originally, but not from Park X specifically. It's a beautiful neighborhood in terms of its village-like qualities, let's say. It's like people are really interconnected. You know, obviously, there's people from all different walks of life, from all around the world. And so just like really intricately knit communities and cultures. Over the 7 years living in our apartment, we got to know our neighbors really well, talked a lot with our neighbors about doing things like Ruelle Verte. We've had family members come to town and like stay with our neighbors and things like that. It's just been like a really special relationship in terms of getting to know people on our block. Yeah, and then we had a kid about a year and a half ago, and he's wonderful. And it's kind of like, I think in a way we recognize now maybe that like the apartment is not our forever home, in the sense that like there's things about it that are not ideal for a toddler. It's the third floor of a triplex, and it's got like some steep dropaways, and you know, like the stairs can be a bit scary and things like that. But there's obviously an emotional connection because it's our son's first home. And, you know, we have all these really sweet memories now of, you know, bringing him home from the hospital and just like watching him grow up, take his first steps, et cetera, say all his first words in this apartment. And the building was sold. So for most of the 7 years there, it was just owned by this guy who was like a businessman. You know, he lived in the suburbs, and I would say he was like moderately responsible in terms of the upkeep of the building. He was a nice person. I think I've always had conflictual relationships with landlords just because of the kind of person I am, where I very much like reject the power imbalance that's inherent in the landlord-tenant relationship. But we kind of had a very, let's say, like almost like transactional relationship with our previous landlord, where like something needed to get done, he would generally do it in a reasonable turnaround. We fought him almost every year on the rent hikes, or like what we would do is like he would propose something that would be like above the limit set out by the TAL. We would come back to him and say, we reject that. It's above the limit. Here's what we're proposing. We were always able to just like negotiate in good faith with him to like bring him down to like a reasonable rent increase. So we managed to like keep the rent pretty low over the years. And then he sold the building almost exactly a year ago. So yeah, like February of 2023. We kind of like knew from the get-go when the building was sold, was like it was going to be trouble. We even told ourselves like we really want to make this very uncomfortable for the new potential buyers. So like we refused to clean our house. Actually, the realtors didn't even ask to come by to take photos for the real estate listing of our place, because I think they just knew that like we had a baby and like our house is completely in disarray. And then like when potential buyers would come by, like we would just like basically keep our apartment as is, like with like toys and like shit strewn everywhere. So like the buyers would have to be like stepping over all these toys, and we wanted to make it really obvious that like, yeah, there's a family here and there's a kid here, and you know, if you're moving in, just make sure you know that, because we intend to stay. And I think we actually said that like straight up to some of the potential buyers, and I was like interrogating them. Like, what's your intention with buying this place? And like their own like realtor would be like, we're just here on a visit. Like we, you know, like silly saying like lay off. And I would like tell the new buyers about all the mice and like just like things to maybe like try to bring down the property value a little bit.
But, scare them off.
Yeah, kind of scare them off. But it did get sold. And then at first we were kind of optimistic, because what happened was, so yeah, it's a triplex. And then the people on the first floor actually just left on their own accord. They like bought another place. So the first floor apartment was empty, which kind of worked out perfectly, because it meant like, okay, at first no one's going to have to get evicted. And the person who bought it just moved in on the first floor. And we thought, okay, well, at least the owner lives in the building. Maybe that means they'll be a little bit more invested in the upkeep of the place. And yeah, like sure enough, in the first few months, there was repairs that need to get done, and like he did them. And then months go by, and then we learn, oh, like, okay, he's got a son who is renting age, and like that's never good. So then we started to get a bit more nervous, because it was coming up on the deadline to send eviction notices. He actually like he kind of gave us a heads up on the phone. He said, I want to come by and visit with my son, because, you know, just to be honest, I want to have my son move into the apartment. And at the time, I just lost it on the phone with him. I gave him a real earful. And I said, basically, like, shame on you. There's a family that lives here. And I even tried, even in that state, I tried to negotiate with him by saying, you know, like, look, like, again, this isn't our forever home, but at least give us a little bit of wiggle room. Like, it's going to be too stressful and too soon if you kick us out next July 1st. But, you know, just talk to us every year and, like, let's just come to something where we can both, like, mutually agree on. He basically just said, F that, I'm getting you guys out. You know, sent us the avis de repris de logement for his son, like the repossession order. And
so you got that in December?
Yeah, we got that in December. Yeah, I mean, it just put like an intense amount of stress on us, because I think one thing that we hadn't realized is that, well, we were aware that rents and that real estate had gone up dramatically during the pandemic. But I think if you manage to hold on to your home as a renter during the pandemic, you just kind of like weren't necessarily fully aware how dire the situation has become. And then once you're put in a situation where you're forced to start looking, it was really desperate and depressing. And, you know, we were paying what we are paying, just over $1,000 for 5.5 with 2 bedrooms. And it's, you know, it's the apartment has its share of problems. I would say being very mouse infested is probably the first, but, you know, it's a fixer upper in some senses. But then it's, yeah, just like $1,000 for a 2-bedroom apartment is just like unheard of now in any neighborhood. And we start to look around. And I think like a few things that are shocking are that one is, I actually find rental prices don't really differ that much from neighborhood to neighborhood, at least within the parts of the city that are within a proximity of a metro station. It's just that to me is really strange how it's so sought after now to live by a metro station that people are willing to pay a lot of money. And there's been a lot of gentrification in those neighborhoods. So yeah, we started to see that the kind of low end for rent for a 2-bedroom would be like $1,700, and then it can go up to $2,000 or even much more if like the place is like fully renovated. So that's been really stressful. And we've been applying to co-ops as well too, and had a couple interviews at co-ops that just didn't really pan out. So it's really it's upended our lives and just like put a lot of stress and tension on the family. And we're trying to remain optimistic. You know, like at first we were thinking like we're very reliant on services that are close to us in Park X. So like our kid goes to like a great CPE that's just a few blocks away. And we just, for the first time in our lives, got a family doctor who's like literally around the corner. And we just didn't want to give any of those things up. And now we're just kind of saying, well, yeah, we might have to move neighborhood. It's just going to mean more commute time for certain things.
Are you quite certain that your landlord does indeed have a son that he's going to give the apartment to?
Yeah, we're fairly certain. I mean, he came and visited with someone who he said was his son. Okay. I think if we had been, let's say, in a situation where we didn't have a child and felt like we had more energy to be combative, I think we would have seen it through in terms of challenging it at the tribunal. But we kind of got advice from our neighborhood tenants group to essentially try to make a settlement with him, because, you know, what we heard, and of course, like, you know, no one should take this as legal advice. I think it's what I always tell people is definitely if you're facing this, just go talk to, you know, your neighborhood comité de logement, because they're an amazing line of defense. But what we'd heard is that if you contest it, and if you get a hearing in front of the TAL, and if you lose, the most they're going to offer you is essentially moving fees. So yeah, somewhere in the neighborhood of like $1,500. So we came to our landlord with a higher offer than that. We said, look, like, we'll save everyone's time by not fighting this. Pay us out a settlement. And then the other thing we demanded, and we really dug our heels in, and I'm glad to say we won it, is just like, the right to break the lease at any point between now and July 1st. So that at the very least gives us flexibility in terms of like, right. If an apartment,
if we find something
tomorrow,
sooner,
yeah, yeah, we could take it.
And do you mind telling us what kind of settlement you got?
Yeah, I mean, the settlement was $5,000. And, okay, you know, in retrospect, I actually wish it had been more than that, just because now we're even looking at the option of buying, because we looked at the rental prices and then we looked at like what we would be paying in terms of monthly mortgage fees. And it wasn't that huge of a difference. Then we said, you can definitely get a better quality home if you buy. So we're looking at that, but it's, you know, we know that our monthly expenses are going to double at the very least. So yeah, we should have perhaps asked for more, but then at the same time, it's like, if he was doing the repossession in good faith, mm-hmm, then he could have just said, well, no, like, this is within my right to do this. I don't owe you all this money.
Just because you asked for a bigger settlement doesn't mean you would have gotten it. So at least you got 5,000, which is something. Yeah.
I think the key thing for us is just at least, the very least, having the peace of mind that we can leave before July 1st if we need. That's been good leverage in terms of doing a house hunt right now and just being able to look at things that are coming up right away. And there's a certain, like, I don't want to say comfort, because it's not a comfortable situation, but like, you definitely have a feeling of solidarity when you know that there's just so many people facing this situation. I think a lot of it, and again, I don't have any sympathy for landlords, but I think what's happening is that because mortgage interest rates are so high right now, landlords can't afford to keep tenants in their buildings that are paying well below the market rate as we were. Yeah. And so I think that's the reason why we're seeing evictions happening.
It's one reason.
I think that's one reason. I think there's so many landlords that are obviously just out there for blood and wanting to make a profit. But obviously there's regulation needed at some point, because housing has just become this crazy luxury and commodity. And we just keep saying to ourselves, I mean, you know, I think this whole experience has really changed the way I see Montreal and the way I feel about Montreal, because I used to love the city because of its affordability and accessibility and livability. And now I just don't feel that anymore. Yeah, it's changed our outlook on a lot of things. Like, to give you another example, it's like an opportunity came up for us to do a lease transfer. You know, this is obviously something that the government could outlaw like any day now. And this lease transfer, without getting into the specific details of it, it was for an apartment that was in an amazing location at an insanely low rent, because the woman who would have been transferring us the lease had been there for like 25 years. And I actually turned it down because I felt like I would have been making myself into a target moving into a place where the rent was so low. And I just figured, like, any landlord in their right mind would kick out, like, would do an eviction for a tenant.
Do you have any advice for people that would be going through the same thing?
Yeah, for sure. So like I said, I mean, I think like never accepting anything your landlord says at face value is really important. So like, always demanding everything in writing. You know, in our case, our landlord got out his little mini violin and was like trying to like play the sob story in terms of like why he was evicting us. And he would be calling me to try to like put emotional pressure. And I just said, at some point said, like, absolutely under no circumstances are you to call me to discuss this. If you want to communicate about this eviction, it's going to be over email. We're going to have everything in writing. Mm-hmm. Everything has to be a paper trail. And then, you know, I think in Montreal, the only thing now that's like basically the stopgap against like total housing apocalypse is the fact that we have this amazing network of tenants' rights groups that exist in basically every neighborhood. And like, those really need to be utilized to their full extent, because they're doing really amazing organizing. And so, you know, in Park X, we have the CAP, like the Comité Action Park Extension. You know, they're phenomenal because they're not only trying to do like individual support with people who are facing these tough situations, but they're also doing community organizing. So like bringing a whole bunch of people together who are in the same situation. And that's, yeah, like I said, it's really our last line of defense against speculation and gentrification and evictions. Like people ask all sorts of like housing rights questions on Facebook. And I've just like, I've seen a lot of misinformation too, right? Like we all love to kind of like have our little lawyer hat on and like answer people's questions. And you should really only get legal advice from people who are either lawyers themselves or are experts in the domain, like people who work for housing rights groups. So, you know, I don't think it's ever a good idea to crowdsource legal advice on social media. And I think just like talking to your neighborhood tenant association, like those would be like my two biggest pieces of advice to people.
So as you say, you feel confident that you'll find something, you're looking into your options and you have a couple of months. And
yeah, I really hope. I mean, it's it feels really like the market just feels so competitive and that feels gross and awful, but I'm just trying to be optimistic about it. So hard, man, so don't trip me up. Shake your leg like the tail of a pup. I'm paying dues till I register heat. Sure hope I don't end up on the street. Homeboy, homeboy, everybody needs a home. Homeboy, homeboy, everybody needs a home. So many people rise and fall. Who's looking after you at all? Nobody knows anybody at all. Strangers in paradise down at the mall. Homeboy, homeboy, everybody needs a home. Homeboy, homeboy, everybody needs a home.
Many thanks to our anonymous interviewee for sharing his story and perspective. It always sucks to get pushed out of your home and neighborhood, and it's extra stressful to add apartment hunting in this housing market to just the regular stress of raising a toddler. So wishing best of luck to this month's interviewee. In other sad news, on Wednesday this week, Bill 31 became a law. This means that lease transfers are now essentially dead. Lease transfers, as most of you know, were for a long time a way to pass low rents on to other tenants, ensuring that landlords couldn't hike rents between leases. Well, with the new law, landlords can refuse a lease transfer to a new tenant without any justification whatsoever. The new law does have a few tiny pro-tenant tidbits. For example, tenants no longer have to bring a form to the TAL to refuse an eviction notice. They can simply not respond, and this will automatically be seen as a refusal. Also, landlords are now legally required to compensate tenants when evicting them. So landlords will have to pay for moving costs and 1 month's worth of rent for every year the tenant has spent in the apartment, with a cap of 24 months of rent, 2 years of rent. So tenants can also now ask for damages if they can prove their landlord kicked them out on false pretenses, and they can ask for damages if they find out the landlord lied about the amount of rent paid previously. This brings us to the end of our Radio Renoviction broadcast for the month of February. Thank you again to our anonymous interviewee, and also to CKUT and Jack Solar for finding a space on the airwaves to broadcast these stories. Also, thank you to our listeners for supporting CKUT. Radio Renoviction is produced by Clara Swan Kennedy, Madeline Lyons, and myself, Caroline Künzley. If you're interested in telling us your story, please write to us at radiorenoviction@ckut.ca. We'll be back in a month's time on the last Friday of March at 5 p.m. Until then, take good care.
Child, I wouldn't use my head. Remember what the old folks said.
Oh, you just can't win by making that same mistake. Oh, Lord, you just can't win by making that same mistake. I'm here to tell you, oh, and oh.
The blind can't be the blind. Son, always keep this in mind.
Oh, you just can't win by making that same mistake. Say it again. You just can't win by making that same mistake. Oh, no. Over and over again.
Hallelujah.
Over and over again. Well, well, well. His punch. Oh, he's live and catches lunch. The element of surprise will make a whole lot of people realize.
Sometimes you find that you hit a pinch, and some games are won by the inch. The motto of winning men is don't make that same mistake again.
Oh, no, you just can't win.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
Just take it on me, boy. Take it on me, boy. Take it like a night. Just take it on me. Take it on me. Do what you gotta do. Give me up all night. Hurt me bad, then it hurts inside. et qui saignait du nez après qu'il soit rentré dans une porte patio fermée, sans rire de lui?
Évidemment.
Avec ton empathie, tu as de l'avenir en santé et services sociaux. Trouve ta place sur québec.ca/carrière en santé. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
I'm Julia Kent, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Hello, and welcome to the All Things Palestinian podcast, a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East. Together, we dive into the realm of what it means to be Palestinian. We explore all aspects of Palestinian culture and art, as well as history and politics, to encourage Palestinian pride and engagement. Today, we are joined by Fargo Tebechi, a queer Palestinian-American writer and performance artist who explores themes of erasure and colonization and imagines a new reality for a liberated Palestine. My name is Tom Woodley. I'm co-host of the All Things Palestinian podcast, and I'm filling in today for Rafif Tejani, who's away on holiday. And normally I would be joined by our co-host Tyla Shahr, but she unfortunately has been sick for a few days and actually feverish. So our sympathies go out to Tyla, and Tyla, we wish you a quick recovery. Can't wait to have you back with us, but we're going to forge ahead, and we're thrilled, as I mentioned earlier, to have Fargo Tebechi with us today. He's an up-and-coming Palestinian diaspora figure, so I'll just introduce him. Fargo is a queer Palestinian-American writer and performance artist based in Washington, D.C., and winner of the 2018 Ghassan Kanafani Resistance Art Prize. His writings have been published in various literary publications, including the Berkeley Review, among others. He's also the recipient of several fellowships. Fargo's writings and performance challenges notions of erasure and colonization, and they propose a reality of a free and unoccupied Palestine. So welcome, Fargo.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, well, appreciate your taking the time. And I was looking, of course, doing a little poking around on the internet the past few days and learning more about you in advance of this interview. And you're obviously forward-thinking, cutting-edge artist, and bringing to the fore these issues that are so important to all of us. But let's start at the beginnings. Where in Palestine are you from?
Yeah, my father's family is from El Khalil, and his father worked making the chassis for the back of trucks. So they would make, it was a lot of wood and metalwork, these really large kind of things that would hold objects that were transported. And in 67, they lost their land and so moved to Amman in Jordan, which is where my father grew up. Okay. And then he came to the United States to work in the 90s, and that's where he met my mother. And so I was born here in the States, in California.
Well, let's talk a little bit. Of course, you grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. What are your best memories of your time there, and what are some of the more difficult ones?
It's a good question. I liked Phoenix actually quite a bit. So I was born in California, and when I was about 12, my family and I moved to Arizona just because it was cheaper, and the cost of living in California was going up and up, and it was harder to, especially for my mom, who really raised me and my siblings by herself in large part. Phoenix took some adjusting to, but it's a place that I've grown to really love and miss in a lot of ways. It's really beautiful. You know, the desert is a really lovely place to be, especially when it's not the summer and 120 degrees. So Phoenix was it's a really interesting city, and it's going through a lot of changes right now, especially for some reason. It's kind of becoming a hub where people move, and cost of living is going up there as well, which is, you know, true for many places in the United States. But for some reason, Phoenix has a kind of focus right now. Yeah. Growing up, And in general, much of my sense of my Palestinian-ness, you know, and that aspect of identity is really connected to my father. Yeah. And so there are a lot of complications and sort of nuances within that relationship, especially at that time, right, when I was growing up in Arizona. My father lives in Jordan, and that is partially due to the complications and machinations of law in the United States, and troubles in and out of trouble with the law, and so that absence, which was and was not a fault of anyone's, I suppose, made I think my relationship to you know, thinking about Palestine and thinking about Arabness in Phoenix, complicated in a lot of ways. It's a word I'm coming back to, even though I generally don't like that word. but so I'm thinking about, you know, visibility a little bit, and community in Phoenix in terms of Palestinians. There were other small pockets of Palestinian Americans and Palestinians that lived there that I was able to connect to in various ways. But this central tension between that sort of shaped the relationship between me and my father and me and notions of Palestinian identity, I think, led to me really wanting to and needing to take time to understand how to talk about that before I started making work, especially, but even just kind of openly talking about Palestine and my place within its diaspora. And so for me, I'm thinking a little bit about visibility and sort of this need sometimes and the value of claiming our identity for sure. But I think that also comes with a lot of costs very often. Yeah. And I think that it's very, very easy for our expressions of Palestinian identity to be taken up in ways that we don't intend. And forced into a larger national discourse that it's very hard to get out of. Yeah. So for me, because it is so deeply bound up with my relationship with my father, I had to really first learn how to talk about that relationship, and how to talk about him in ways that did not give him up to a kind of discourse that would minimize his humanity. It's a little bit vague, I suppose, the things that I'm talking about, but I'm sort of trying to, I think, communicate that it really was about, for me, finding language that couldn't be co-opted to describe what it means to me to be Palestinian, and what it means to me to think about that relationship coming from my father. So all of that for me is really bound up in the time that I was growing up in Phoenix. And it's a place where I hold a lot of that pain, but also a lot of the community relationships and mentors and teachers that gave me the language I needed to be able to talk and make work and engage in ways that didn't feel icky, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. How did you become interested in writing and performance art and poetry?
Yeah, I've always been drawn to those things in various forms ever since I was very, very young, which I think is a stock answer for a lot of, especially performers, who will say, when I was 5 years old, I was putting on shows for my family. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I think that's just being a child. But I certainly did that. And I think it really started taking the shape or starting to take the shapes that it takes now. When I was in college, I started in a more traditional theater space. You know, that's really where I come from is acting on stage, and coinciding with a lot of those internal changes and conversations that we were just talking about in regards to identity and the things that comes with it, the necessities and commitments that I think come with really engaging and embracing a particular identity. Those things really coincided with, for me, some disillusionment with the kind of theater that I was making at the time. And so I started to be curious about ways that I could use performance and the things I loved about it to engage with the world in ways that these other parts of my life were starting to necessitate for me. Yeah. And the thing that really broke that open in many ways was finding performance studies, which in the space that I encountered, it really emerges from the field of communications and looking at performance as a way of being in the world, and the especially the ways that our identities take shape and are reified and made concrete in the ways that I see someone perform Palestinian, for example, and I learn that that is a script for how to be Palestinian. And these things emerge from all sorts of spaces. They emerge from our communities and our families, but also from the kinds of discourses that emerge from the United States and from the media and from news. And so there's a lot of conflicting performances. And for me, thinking about my own love of performance as a space and a genre where things are not stable opened up the possibility for negotiating different meanings for identity and creating new shapes and new performances and new scripts for what that might mean for myself as a body in the world. So really, I started to think about myself as a subject and a performer to write through and with. And at the same time, I really started writing poetry more seriously. I had written poetry in high school that was awful, truly, truly horrible. And along with this new interest in finding a more theory-based, a more critically rigorous form of performance, it also led me to revisit forms of writing that I hadn't taken on in a while. And so, you know, even just going back to our earlier conversation, I think finding for myself the language that felt right and accurate and sharp enough to describe who I was and to describe what that meant for me made it possible to revisit spaces like performance and poetry, which are slippery in a way that I think is very, very useful. They operate in ways that can step outside of more stable meanings in the world, of things that are rigid. And that was very valuable to me at that time and still remains valuable. So there was really, I think, for myself, when I was, you know, 18 or 19, a kind of explosion of being able to merge these new understandings of myself with the forms of expression that I had always loved. And so that's really, I would locate that as the start of the trajectory of work that I've been making for the past few years.
Yeah. I think people who haven't, what's the word for it? Sort of people who don't have sort of divided identities. Myself, I grew up in North America. I've lived here, apart from vacations and the occasional trip abroad, I've lived my whole life in North America. And I think, and my parents were born in North America. And I think people with sort of split identities or multicultural identities, they go through things, obviously, that many people don't.
Yeah, but even to go back to your experience, I think it's useful sometimes to look at the ways that all of us are already born into some kind of shape of those expectations. For example, the shape that you are born into as someone who is very connected to North America, for example, your identity as an American is predefined in so many ways for you. Yeah. And all of these relationships that we have in the world start to and continue to shape what that means. Yeah. And the same thing is true for you as it is for other Palestinians, although the dynamics and kinds of performances that are demanded of you are different than are demanded of me or are demanded of someone who is a Palestinian living in Palestine, for example. But they all share a circulating network of demands and expectations and predefined shapes. And so the idea, I think, of performance for me, and a lot of times, I think, especially now when we talk about performance or things that are performative, we mean that to mean false or inauthentic, which is not how I understand the word. I understand it really to be about the fact that these demands and shapes of what it means to be a certain thing are written for us, but they are not true in a kind of objective meaning of the sense. They are not the clothes that we have to wear throughout the rest of our life. They are not the performances we have to continue to live inside of. And so for me, what's really exciting about thinking of performance, for example, as a way of understanding those kinds of demands or expectations is that it means they're not stable. It means that I can go off script. It means that I can improvise and find ways to step outside of the stages that have been set for me as a person, as a Palestinian, as a man, as someone who it was also born and raised in North America, for example. So, I think it's about knowing that we get to decide for ourselves every day and re-decide what it means to be who we are and what that entails and what that necessitates about who we are with others as well, right? Yeah. That it's not an individual thing, but who